It is the Film Study Podcast, Film Study with Ken McCusick, Episode 7, where we get to break down the play, I guess, of the Ravens this past week as they lost 77-44. This is the defensive week. Ken, how are you doing back from London?
Well, good trip until the game, so life goes on after the game.
Yeah, I talk often about how sometimes when the Orioles or Ravens lose games, it kind of ruins my day. It was no fun having your day ruined at 9:30 in the morning on a Sunday.
Bad time for a game, I agree. Didn't really seem that bad over there. It's 2:30 in the afternoon. Almost seemed a long time to wait for football from what we're used to, going to a 1 o'clock game at home. But, you know, middle of the afternoon, some unfamiliar environments to get around, but pretty easy really to get to Wembley and go to the game. We did go to Stonehenge. That was probably the highlight of the trip, given how the game went. But, you know, in order of importance, Stonehenge is a 3. Going to other museums were a 1, and winning that game was 100. So.
All right, now you're blowing my mind. How far away is Stonehenge? I didn't know it was near there.
It's a couple hours away. It's a couple hours west, southwest, really, of London.
Okay. All right, and it would have been really nice if we could use Stonehenge to like describe our defense, and a bunch of big boulders and stone walls there. But
a creative guy with artwork. I'm sure you can stick that into the theme somehow.
I could, except that the Jags just knocked it down constantly. So before we get into the game itself, where I'm sure we're going to have a lot of negative and a lot of negative play to talk about. I assume you had a better trip than the Ravens did. How is football? What's it like going to a game in London?
Well, it's just kind of a circus atmosphere if you really get down to it. A lot of things that we would consider very annoying. I don't know about you. I'm not really a fan of the band at the ballgame, and I'm not really a fan of other things that distract from the game, like cameras rolling in front of you and whatnot. So a good example of the kind of thing that bothers me with the London game is they had a guy on stilts jumping around in the end zone.
Stilts.
They also had stilts. He's on stilts, and his stilts are pogo sticks. I guess that's the way to describe them.
Could he?
And
he's like,
doing backflips and whatnot.
Jump through the goalpost.
He probably could. He was flipping over forwards and backwards, and I'm like, I would if I was sitting there, this would just be driving me nuts.
Yeah, so, that's weird.
Yeah. It's they have a lot of things. It's a soccer field is bigger than a football field, wider in particular, and you really get a sense of that. You're fairly further from the field that you would be for one of our games at home, and it's a little bit different environment. The entire funneling you in, funneling you out is it's well handled. You know, they have a lot of trains ready to go to take you away, but it's also packed.
How's the atmosphere handled? Do they treat it like it's a Jaguars home game as far as jumbotrons and sounds and stuff?
Yes. So the Jaguars people are in charge, evidently, of the video boards and of the audio system as well, because you hear an American voice clearly on the audio. But the video boards were all Jaguars highlights and whatnot. It wasn't a Ravens home game.
All right. What was the crowd like?
Our crowd was very unusual in the fact, you ever gone on a trip with your family and done the license plate game where you try and see all the states you can collect by
making
a license? Sure, yep. Anyway, if you did that for every NFL jersey, you'd have it in about 20 minutes. You know, it's just every NFL jersey is present there. Maybe 40% of the total jerseys were Jaguars or Ravens, with most of those being Ravens. But it was definitely a very, very mixed allegiance crowd.
How about American versus English crowd?
You know, that's a little harder for me to tell you for sure. I'd certainly say it's got to be 70-75% English. There's 80,000 people there roughly, so you know that's a large crowd. I don't think there's more than 20,000 Americans there.
Okay. I guess my final question about the location and the game and the presence is, does this make you more or less in the camp of there should be football full-time in London?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's enough interest to have football full time there. I think we're getting to that point. The question would be, what? How do you add London to any existing division? I don't think you can. So you either have to do a rotating series of games, which I think probably makes the most sense. Maybe play a Super Bowl there someday, which is, you know, it's obviously a big change for American. For Americans to have the Super Bowl be exported.
That's a lot of money for America to send over there.
That's a good point. You know, they'd have to obviously make it up in TV. There'd have to be other ways to merchandise for it and whatnot that they could make up for it. They probably could. But in any case, it's there is enough interest, I think. I think the World Football League had some interest. So maybe rotating around to more European cities is the next step, to the point where you get every team playing one game per year in Europe. You know, and I'm not really a fan of that. I don't want to go to London again for another game, but, you know,
right.
It is what it is.
How was the travel? It's, what, 6.5 hours by normal plane?
I think if you go, probably about that, or 7 hours. We went via Iceland to get there, so we took a little bit longer to get there. And so you take two flights, and it's like 5.5 and 3.5, roughly, and you're there.
Right, and I'm sure the players are just a direct flight.
Oh, yeah. The whole notion that they were going to sleep, everything was going to be normal except that they were going to sleep on Thursday night, I think it was, on the plane.
That doesn't make any sense.
It's just ridiculous.
Yeah. Right. They're all guys who are bigger than an airline seat.
Yeah.
And they're not going to sit comfortably. They're not going to sleep comfortably. You've got a quarterback with a bad back already. There's no way he's sleeping sitting in a plane.
That's right. And even they talked about the lie flat beds and whatnot they had, and then one of the players was saying, well, I couldn't stretch my feet out in this. Well, of course not. He's 6'6".
Right, know? Right. Unless you're gonna get a UPS plane that's completely empty and lay some real beds in there, you're not sleeping.
Yeah. If you've ever been to the castle, this is one of the interesting things about it. Their auditorium room has the biggest seats you'll ever see. So you get in these seats and you're like, what am I swimming in here? You know, they're enormously wide. But they are to make the players comfortable.
Then that's going to be my thing. If the NFL wants to have football rotating through Europe, they need to buy up airplane and customize it for the football teams. I guess it would be two airplanes, and help somehow make this travel better. Because for the East Coast teams, it's not that much different than going to California.
Not that much different. Yeah, you're right. It's two more time zones than going to California. It's a couple more hours. So it's the worst travel there is in the NFL. Other than maybe going to Mexico would be worse. I don't really know. But it's the worst travel. Mexico is really bad because they fly you in and out the same day and play the game. They don't trust your teams to stay there overnight.
That's got its own issues then.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess it's where we're at. We know we're progressing this way. So hopefully the Ravens do not have to do it again for a long, long time.
Yep, I think we all agree on that one.
All right, let's get into the game. But before we get into real deep, this is the defensive episode. We've talked before about the defense and how it's not good to just be average on defense and to just be flat and average on every part of defense, that you really need parts that are above average.
Yeah, that's right. You need variation on defense. So maybe explaining that a little bit broader. Defense requires variation. So if you look at the offense and they got average yards per play on every play, they would robotically move down the field at 4 yards a run or 6 yards a pass and make every first down and score every drive. But the defense obviously is then the side that is really has to try and force variation in the game. And they do so. They have four ways to do that. They can do it by turnovers. That's the most obvious. They can do it by sacks, which create large negative pass plays at once. They can do it by offensive penalties, and oftentimes holding penalties will stall a drive, for example. And they can do it with key incomplete passes or a sequence of incomplete passes. But otherwise, it's very hard to stop a team on three or four downs, and they will more often than not get a first down on three.
Sure, and the first 2 weeks, it was turnovers. Turnovers were the big thing.
That's right. So they did it with turnovers. They did it with sacks. They put some teams in some unbelievably bad positions where they gave up in the game You know, some of those teams almost look like the Bengals wanted a punt on third down some of that time. Each of the Browns and Bengals each had some serious penalties. But if you look at what happened against the Jags, they didn't have any turnovers. We know that. They didn't have any sacks, so they weren't changing, you know, down and distance dramatically with any sacks. The Jaguars had two holding penalties that didn't stall drives. That's really bad. And they also had another holding flag and a false start that happened on the same sequence of downs where they still got a field goal out of it. So all of that is really not taking advantage of the opponent penalties. And then if I just look at the first half, and that's when the Ravens got down 23-0 and the game got out of hand, Bortles had 8 incomplete passes in the first half, and only one of those stalled a drive resulting in a punt. And the other one was on the same set of downs that resulted in settling for a field goal. So they really did not take advantage of the incomplete passes either. So just a bummer of an effort to watch defensively. And, you know, variation was not there.
All right. I want to get into the pass rush. But before we get into there, I want to get into Blake Bortles. Is he suddenly a decent quarterback?
No, he's not.
Okay.
I don't think so.
So you're leaning more on the Ravens were that bad.
I think it was a game where the Ravens failed to get the pressure that they had in the earlier games. So all of their nice situations for getting turnovers, all of the we have the lead where they're forced to pass, they're forced to really throw into the coverages we want, and we're winning all the one-on-one matchups at the line of scrimmage. All of that wasn't present in
all this
game.
So falling behind early is really, really hurt the defense.
That is really bad. I mean, obviously, it creates a low turnover environment when you fall behind early.
All right. We've talked in the first 2 weeks that the Ravens don't blitz a whole lot the first 2 weeks. We said, well, maybe they're holding back because they don't need to. How was the pass rush in week 3?
Well, that's a good point. You mentioned the blitz right away, and that's a very important. That P's only called 3 blitzes from off the line of scrimmage the entire game. One by Anoso, one by Mosley, and one by Correa. And that's just not enough for a whole game. I mean, I'm counting up typical games. I'm seeing 10 or 11 in the past. When you go back to the Ryan years, you'll see even more than that. There's just not enough blitz to create deception. And in fact, by my definition of deceptive blitzing, which we've talked about before, and I don't want to have to go over every show, but they only had one deceptive blitz the entire game, and that was on the very first pass play. They rushed 5. Anoso came on a blitz, and they had Suggs stunt. And the combination of those two things creates a deceptive blitz, and they still threw a 35-yard pass.
And the Ravens, when we think of the good Raven defense teams, it was a lot of that deceptive blitz. That Rex Ryan, that's what they did, was deceptive blitz. You didn't know who was coming in.
That's right. Ryan used every component of deception allowed. Lewis liked to blitz a lot, and he liked to stunt a lot. So he used those components of deceptions. Nolan did a variety of things, including using the dime and using defensive backs to blitz a fair amount. So, you know, they all had their things they liked to do, and they all involved a lot more deception than Pease did.
Is it a talent issue, or is it a Dean Pease issue?
No, this is a schematic choice, in my opinion. You know, the outside linebackers let the team down, but they needed to be helped with scheme, given how weak the Ravens were on the interior defensive line at getting pressure with the loss of Williams and Urban in this game.
All right, and without those blitzes, without the deception, I'm guessing that left him up for lots of ample time and space.
Yep, that's correct. So in the first half alone, they had 15 out of 24 ample time and space opportunities, which is a lot. So that's 62.5%, and that would normally win you the game on its own.
Right.
But of those 9, there were 5 where they were really designed to have the ball out quickly. So they were BOQ, where there wasn't actually pressure created, but I also couldn't decide if the pocket would hold up for a full 3 seconds or not, so I had to label it that way. Those aren't real pressure. There was only 4 manufactured pressures in the first half by the defense. Obviously, in 24 passes, that's not going to get it done.
No, if the quarterback is not feeling pressure, suddenly a bad quarterback can make good throws.
That's a great way to put it. You make a lot of bad quarterbacks into good quarterbacks without pressure.
We're going to get to the linebackers and all and go to individual grades. I guess with the ample time and space, do you think you keep saying that DMP's just the scheme wasn't right? Is that part of this ample time and space that our scheme was so soft that they had time to just pick it apart?
Well, I think in this game, I would say yes. Now, the first 2 weeks, the Ravens were able to rush four very consistently, get pressure because they were winning one-on-one matchups, and that was causing the quarterback to make mistakes. And you make mistakes into a seven-man secondary or even an eight-man secondary sometimes, and that was creating a lot of opportunity for turnovers. Well, in this game, first of all, Bortles looked pretty smart with the ball. He threw it away whenever he really needed to just throw it away. But the other thing is that the Ravens were not winning the one-on-one matchups up front, and that's the time when Dean Pees needs to change and go to something schematically that will allow the Ravens a better chance to get pressure. Now, one thing that the Ravens have really succeeded in the first two games, was having Brandon Williams, who had seven pressures in a limited number of pass rush snaps, only about 27 or so that he played, and Brent Urban creating a lot of inside pressure. Now, inside pressure helps a lot. You hear it said that the worst pressure for the quarterback is the pressure directly in his face. And those guys were creating it, and now they're both gone. Williams is gone. We don't know for how long, but I don't think he's playing this week because I haven't heard anything positive about it. Now, Urban is a Liz Frank injury, and that's a tragic injury for him and the Ravens because I think it probably ends his Ravens career right now. It's going to be very hard to figure out how to structure a contract that works for a couple of years from this point. Hopefully they can do it, but Urban appeared to be a very big talent who, at the worst, the Ravens would have lost this offseason for a compensatory draft pick.
Right. Well, let's get started there with Urban, who went out after 18 snaps. So the loss of him and a loss of Brandon Williams, is that enough of an excuse to say why the Ravens did so poorly?
In this game, from a pass rush standpoint, I'd say yes. The remaining guys, Pierce, Davis, and Henry, along with a few snaps of Patrick Ricard, had very little total pressure. I can give you that in just a second here. Let's see. Where's my chart? I don't have it right in front of me. They had two total pressures from the interior defensive linemen. This includes Urban in 74 snaps. So only one non-Urban pressure from the inside. That's not going to get it done.
All right. Let's go through the players then. Let's go with Willie Henry.
Okay. So Willie Henry got his first NFL playing time in this game. Played 40 snaps. And that's a heck of a debut when you get to play 40 snaps. Usually it's three snaps or five snaps, as we saw from Ricard. It had one snap in his debut, plus a few on offense. But to get 40 snaps, you were obviously there by need. And he did pretty well. He stuffed the run effectively four times, gains of 2 of 3 yards and 2 of 1 yards. And a run stuff is defined as one where by down and distance, the offense doesn't get the percentage of the yardage to gain that they hope to get. So on first down, they have to get 45%, and on second down, they have to get 60%. Okay. On third down, they have to get 100% of it. But anyway, had four stuffs in the game. All of them were nice short yardage plays, and he tackled effectively. The problem was he had 18 pass rush snaps, and we saw a lot of disruption from him in the preseason, but he didn't show it in this game. Did not get a single pressure in the game, and he could have really helped.
All right. Well, then I'm hoping some of these other guys helped. Let's go with Carl Davis, who was on the field just as much.
Yeah, Carl Davis, 42 snaps in this game, a sharp increase in play from him. He'd been very much the fourth of four used defensive linemen the last 2 weeks. So his play probably doubled from the previous 2 weeks combined. Similar to Henry, he had three run stuffs. He did also have a flag, so did Henry, by the way. And he generated one pressure in 18 pass rush snaps. So he was the only one other than Urban to generate a pressure from the inside. And again, the Jags' interior line did a darn nice job of stopping Henry, Davis, and Pierce in this game.
All right. Now, I saw a few run stuffs by Michael Pierce.
Yeah. So he is good. He seems to be very good at using his arms to drag down runners, and he had three stuffs in this game. The issue with him is that he was in for 27 pass rush snaps and did not get a pressure. He's got to do more than that, and he's really got to do more than that if he's going to replace what Brandon Williams does for this team. Now, you can't expect anybody to be Brandon Williams, but Michael Pierce has the advantage of being on the nose, and so he has an opportunity to push around some smaller centers as opposed to having to beat a guard for pressure, which typically is going to be more difficult for a big man. So Pierce, anyway, had a disappointing game in terms of his pass rush, like the rest of the interior linemen. Nothing doing in 27 pass rush snaps.
All right. And then Patrick Ricard, or Rickert, he played on both sides of the ball, right?
Yep, played on both sides of the ball, five snaps on defense. His play is honestly nothing to really talk about. He came in four times in goal line formations where the Ravens used four down linemen, and they only had four active, so Ricard had to be one of them. He was otherwise, I think he used about six snaps on offense, might have been seven. So they used him more there still. He's an emergency defensive lineman, as I think the Ravens are using him here, and an occasional offensive player, whether that's a fullback or a wide or a tight end.
It's frustrating that in week three we were using emergency guys in, yes, for emergency positions. Who replaces, if Michael Pierce is going to replace Brandon Williams, who's going to replace Brett Urban?
Well, yeah, that's really the good question. I mean, so Bronson Kafusi was the natural size for it. Kafusi is about 6'6", similar height to Urban then, similar size. Probably will not be as physical a presence as Urban was. It was interesting. Urban walked off the field and he walked right by Kafusi, and you could see Kafusi, I can only say, feeling bad for his fellow linemen is the way I would describe what I saw there. But I think he'll get the first chance. The other guy is Chris Wormley, who's a rookie this year, and he may well play a fair amount too. In fact, I guess that both will be active against the Steelers. Wormley and Kafusi both offer some interior pass rush presence, and that's really right now exactly what the Ravens need without Williams or Urban healthy. So getting those guys both on the field on some passing downs against the Steelers would make a lot of sense to me.
Okay. We're going to have to see, because they definitely need some help there. So that'll be interesting to watch this week and this Sunday what they do. All right, we had eight linebackers again on Sunday.
Right. So they activated five outside linebackers for the game, which they hadn't done yet, but activated all of them: Bowser, Judon, Smith, Suggs, and Tim Williams. So they all split the play, but the disappointment of this game was really Bowser more than the others, although the others didn't do well. Bowser regressed very badly. He won the Defensive Rookie of the Year last week, and he was in coverage, I use that term loosely, of Mercedes Lewis for the first touchdown, the one that put them up 10-0. Maureen turned to me at that point and said, "This looks like it's going to be a long afternoon," and she was oh so right. But that touchdown, he bit on play action and got chipped by Lewis on his way out of the backfield. So he thinks he's by Lewis, but what he's really got to be doing is chasing Lewis, because there's nobody else was responsible for that side of the field. They cleared it out. And he was very late following, and nice easy pitch and catch from Bortles to Lewis for an easy touchdown that really was the beginning of the end. But that wasn't, unfortunately, the end of Bowser's troubles for the day. He lost the edge on two key plays. And once he lost it to a tight end, and that led to a 15-yard run by Fournette to the right side. And the other time, he lost the left edge to the fullback, Bohannon, on a run by Ivory. And the run only went for 9 yards, but it's particularly frustrating because Mosley was visibly upset after the run, and he's emoting on the field, which you probably shouldn't do, but obviously he's trying to indicate his unhappiness with Bowser on that play for not holding the edge. Bowser was removed from the game and did not re-enter after that. So he just played eight snaps, and that was his last snap of the game there. I certainly hope there's not an injury, but I think it's more likely he was benched for what happened on the field. And obviously, Bowser, I know he's one of your favorites, Josh, and you own his jersey. I don't think this is terrible for his future or anything, but this is a regression. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's one of those things where with every rookie, you at some point you're gonna lose, at some point you're gonna fail, and the big question is how do you bounce back from that? And I'm sure that they've got Bowser watching the film of how you screwed up, looking at these plays, how you can handle it better, and I hope that we see him learn from this mistake.
Right, and that's a good point. I mean, we saw something during that game that actually was kind of interesting to me. I think players, when they go to the sideline and Harbaugh has words with them, one thing he wants to see is that player is understanding and taking in the information he's trying to give. And after West fumbled, obviously very upset, but he went to the sideline Ball got returned to the 2-yard line or wherever it was, and West went to the sideline. Harbaugh was having words to him. Harbaugh's back is to us, but West, you can see his face. He's looking everywhere but at Harbaugh. He doesn't want to look Harbaugh straight in the face. That's not what I'd want to see out of a player. And I'm sure that upset John about it, and he kept talking to him on the play. I hope that Bowser is not that same type of player, that he couldn't look Harbaugh straight in the eye and take the criticism, or Pease for that matter, or his position coach, and just understand that, you know, this is a learning experience. He's got to take it that way. But he did get benched for the rest of the game, and it makes me think there might have been something about an interchange there that wasn't good.
This was a tough game for everyone. To give up that many points and to just not be in the game from the first snap, I kind of give a pass to any type of emotional frustration that day from anyone. I feel like no one could handle that well.
Right. I mean, this is a very bad loss. It's one of the worst losses in franchise history. It came to a bad team. I won't say a bad team. It came to a team that is probably near the average of the AFC. Right. Not distinctly above, not distinctly below, but near the average.
A team that's got a shot for the playoffs this year.
They do. They definitely do after this game.
You could not say that about the Jags in many, many years. So they might have something together. We don't know. They're 2-1.
Yeah, they're 2-1. They play in a very weak division, so they certainly have a chance to win it, though Tennessee looks like the class. And you know, now they've won an important tiebreaker against one of the teams that might be there with 9 or 10 wins with them at the end of the year. So it certainly is a possibility they'll make it. And the other thing I'll say is that the other 37-point loss was 37-0 to the Steelers in 1997, and that was one of the most grotesque events to watch that I can ever recall. It was a nationally televised game, which made it worse. At least this game was only available on Yahoo, so the rest of the nation didn't get to watch it, I should say, and enjoy the schadenfreude.
Yeah, the game being on Yahoo is its own other weirdness. I kind of think of any pre-2000 Ravens as kind of the dark times, and took them some time to come alive. It's the first time in a long time we've seen that type of loss, and I won't be burning my Bowser jersey yet. There's plenty of that going around. I'll be leaving my jersey, and I'll wear it on Sunday, and hope that he bounces back. Let's continue on with Correo.
Okay, so I just want to mention one other thing about the outside linebackers before we move on. So there's five of them. We don't have to go into each one specifically, but Bowser, Judon, Smith, Suggs, and Tim Williams were on the field for a combined 73 pass snaps and generated only 5 pressures. 3 of those were pressures, 2 were quarterback hits. Totally unacceptable from the outside linebacker position. It'd be unacceptable if you had great, like if both tackles were Joe Thomas. It's more unacceptable when your two offensive tackles you're working against are Jeremy Parnell and Cam Robinson. Parnell is an old veteran, never really was any good. Cam Robinson, you know, a young guy who's got a lot of problems as a rookie and should not be effective against a crafty pass rusher like Suggs or a physical pass rusher like Za'Darius Smith. It really didn't make any sense that they were able to hold so effectively those Ravens outside linebackers in check. And that's where the game was lost. All the running was to the outside in this game. The outside linebackers were the ones getting beat to the edge. And it's a shame, but that's the position I really put most of the blame on for this game.
All right, outside linebackers, that is the blame.
That is the blame.
I think I'm going to blame the defensive line a little bit too.
Okay.
For not giving them some space, because there was a lot of running, and it seemed like Ivory could go wherever he wanted to.
Okay.
But I mean, that's just my thought watching on Yahoo from the Yahoo broadcast.
See, where you live, you can't get the Channel 13.
You want to know how I watched the game?
Okay.
I on Sundays I go to church.
Okay.
So on Sundays I go to church and I run the sound for the church. So I ran sound on at church on Sunday morning with my iPhone propped up with the game on.
Very good.
So
okay.
and a headphone jack in to listen to the game.
Okay, well, you got to make do with what you got. That's great.
I DVR'd the game thinking I'd go home and really watch it, and then there's no way I'm watching that game ever again.
Yeah, I wish I could say the same thing, but you know, we had a long day of flying yesterday. It's a miserable, you know, long trek, and you're filthy. You come off the plane, all you want to do is really get a shower. But we had to go down there and sit and do the defensive notes, and I had to score the game overnight. So, I'm it's worse,
I
I'll
imagine
say,
so.
but I'm glad that you got to see the game for sure,
I watched the game. I saw every snap. I was very happy that Yahoo made it so easy to watch on my phone.
John. Okay, so let's go back to Camelot Correa because you asked about him.
Yes, because I'm hoping someone on this field had a good game and it looked like he was okay.
Yeah, he really was. He had a few things he did well. He had a nice well-timed blitz where he came off the offensive left side. It was actually disguised well. It was on a screen pass that was headed that way, but he was just in too quickly. And I think it was Grant on the play made no attempt to block him. So he came in, got a hard hit on Bortles to flatten him, and Bortles grounded the ball in front of the screen target. So very good job on that. He did well pursuing to the outside on a short pass for 5 yards, and he did another good job where, you know, this is a distinction made between him and Anwosu. The first is that he covered Bohannon very closely on the right sideline, almost undercut the route for an interception. He did get the pass defensed on the play. That was late in the fourth quarter, but it was still at a point where, you know, you're happy to see any individual player step up and make a play at that point. Anwosu, I'm going to move on to right now. By the way, Correa's best game as a pro, in my opinion, and not even close in these 22 snaps. I expect him to start the next game. Anwosu got the start in this game, finished with 7 tackles, but that really it masked, I'll say, a mediocre day in coverage. He didn't do a good job. He didn't make tackles always. He wasn't in the right spot to cover. Sometimes it's even hard to tell. One reception to Grant went for 18 yards in quarter three with about 14 minutes to go. And he was the nearest in coverage. I'm fairly sure it was his responsibility, yet he was nowhere near, and it went for 10 plus 8, I believe. So that was bad. You know, mentioned that Correa covered Bohannon well. Well, Bohannon's a fullback. He's not a fast guy. So you think about the routes that Leach used to run, or even that Juszczyk used to run, a lot of the shorter ones that were just a 2 to 4 yard out. Well, that's what Bohannon ran. He, in fact, ran a 1 yard out route, and he got hit by Bortles, and then he made 7 yak on a play where he should have had nothing. So that was all due to Peanut being late to the play. So tough game for Peanut, along with a lot of other players in this game. Don't mean to beat on him individually, but he lost ground to Correa in any competition for the ILB spot now.
All right. All right. Well, I mean, I guess we've been watching that position battle, and that's kind of starting to take shape. And you know what? If one guy really steps up and if it's Correa and he's the guy who can hold on to that position, that's good for the Ravens overall.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they really would like for someone to make it obvious who the better player is, because, you know, like John says, you know, Harbaugh, neither of them is playing like an all pro, and that's why neither of them has it.
Right. Speaking of all pros, let's go to the secondary. Now, Blake Bortles was not throwing the ball deep on Sunday. Was
not mostly, not too much.
Mostly short passes. Let's start with Jimmy Smith.
Okay, so the in general, the Raven cornerbacks on the outside in this game, and I'm speaking specifically of Smith, Humphrey, and to a lesser extent Carr even, played pretty well in this game. They really held down the outside receivers fairly effectively. Few inside patterns those guys caught, but generally speaking, they did a pretty good job. And Jimmy Smith played the best of any of them. He allowed one 13-yard completion. 5 times in total he was targeted. 2 of those he knocked away. And the one pass that he was beat for was a 13-yard completion that I just still can't believe Cole made the catch on by the right sideline. So it was two-thirds of the way through the first quarter, approximately 4:23 to go if you want to go look at it. But unbelievable catch by Cole, and the only one Smith allowed. So of the three outside corners, he really played the best. And the fact that Jimmy Smith is playing so well and the Ravens are going in with 3 corners playing at a high level on the outside against those Steeler aircraft carrier long-distance targets makes me feel a lot better.
There was a... The secondary, we can move on to Marlon Humphrey because he was one of the guys But whenever I would see the secondary players, it seemed like it was because of a penalty.
Yeah.
Was the Ravens playing a little looser, a little dirty, or were they being a lot tighter with the defensive pass interference?
Well, the one call on Humphrey, I think, was kind of a bad call, and I guess that's what you're really getting at here. Humphrey, the DPI down the right side on his very ticky-tack. It was 29 yards. He had some contact that was there with his left arm on the receiver's right arm, and he went up for the ball nonetheless. It wasn't like he wasn't looking for the football. He went up for the ball, and he deflected it himself. So usually that negates any willingness for the official to throw the flag, but not in this case. He still got flagged for it. I thought it was a bad call, but it was what it was, and it's a 29-yard hit. Humphrey otherwise had two nice clean PDs. One of them came on a strip and force out of Lee that was on the right side of the end zone. Now, if you're gonna get a receiver, that's a great exacta to get. You strip him and you force him out of the end zone so he can't land in bounds. Very nice double to cut, and that was a two-thirds of the way through Q2. He did a good job on that. He had another play where he undercut a pass. It was about a 20-yard pass intended for Cole between the numbers and the left hash. And he had a PD. It was nearly an interception, but unfortunately the play was negated by Webb's illegal contact flag, which was across the field. So another case where Josh pointed out the flags.
Another secondary penalty.
Yeah. So that was unfortunate. But he had a later PD where I actually thought he could have been called for interference on that play. That was in the end zone. He didn't get the flag there. It was after the ticky-tack DPI, so maybe it was a makeup call. He was not looking for the ball, and I thought he could have been called for it. But it's not hard to imagine Humphrey in this game having four passes defense in only 21 total snaps. So he really played exceptionally well, and it wasn't like he was only playing third down or anything to get only pass snaps. He played rotationally by series. So, he came in and replaced Carr for a series. He came in and replaced Smith for a long series. And in each case, he played very well. And he's right now, by far, he's the Ravens' best yards per play player. The Ravens have allowed just 2.7 yards per play with him in the game and 5.8 yards per play, more than double, with him on the sideline. So he's been very impressive in that regard.
Okay. Speaking of on the field, I think Tony Jefferson was always on the field. Maybe he missed a few plays, but he was out there most of the time.
All right. He went out for a few snaps to deal with the concussion protocol, and nothing had happened. I don't know whether he might have had a stinger or whatever, but he did appear to be hurt when he went down in an awkward kind of a tackle. But he didn't have a great game. And one of the things that was bothersome, he did cover Mercedes Lewis well on the first time they threw into the end zone to him. He had tight man-to-man coverage, and that's what Tony Jefferson came to the Ravens with a reputation as, a guy who can cover a bigger tight end man-to-man. So you thought about that again, and James Lofton called the play. It was like he knew what the playbook was. With the ball at the four-yard line, and this was fairly late in the game, Q3, when the game was already decided anyway, they came out in a jumbo set. Three tight ends, two running backs, but one of the tight ends was Lewis, and Lofton mentioned that maybe you could move Lewis out to the outside and see what happens. And sure enough, he goes out to the outside, Jefferson follows him. I thought, that's a good man matchup for Jefferson, but he just got turned out of the way. Nice, easy jump ball into the end zone. Nothing. There's no fade component. It wasn't, fade component, you throw the ball where the receiver can catch it, but there's no way a cornerback can catch it, so you also reduce the chance for the receiver to catch it. This wasn't that. This was a pure jump ball into a spot in the end zone, and Mercedes Lewis just outmaneuvered Jefferson to the spot, and he couldn't do anything about it. So, good pat catch, a fairly good player at one time a few years back, Mercedes Lewis. Beat the Ravens pretty badly in this game, and we didn't even mention the time he beat Mosley, but three touchdowns and not much could be done about them.
All right. I am not going to make you pick some defensive stars of the game this week. I don't think that would be fair to you with the defense giving up 44. So instead, I just listened to the radio today and came up with some excuses for why the Ravens lost.
Uh-oh.
So our defensive stars of the game are going to be the travel to London.
Okay.
The protests, the fact that the Ravens participated like everyone else. and Peter Angelos. That's what we're going to blame for the game.
He always needs to be blamed for it. You know what? It still might be the 2013 hangover, but not getting the opener at home.
Oh, good,
really
good call.
Could be a factor.
And that all comes down to Peter Angelos. So let's move on to the mailbag, because these guys are a lot smarter than the people who are calling into the radio station.
Yeah, and apparently a lot smarter than us when we had that last minute of discussion there, but let's go ahead.
Oh, I'm sure. Jurgen Hadley asks, who is likely to take the bulk of Urban's snaps? Got into this a little bit. Also, how big of a drop-off should be expected?
Right, that's, you know, it's very difficult to say the drop-off. As I mentioned, I think Bronson Kafusi is going to probably get most of the snaps at the five tech. Wormley will also be available, but I expect him to be more of a tag team partner of Kafusi on passing downs. Willie Henry played a little bit of the five tech as well, so all three of those guys could get some snaps there. But Urban is the Iron Man. I expect that Kafusi is the guy they want as the freshest possible pass rusher at that spot for the plays that he can handle. So how much of a drop-off, we'll have to wait and see. I really don't have a good sense of it. Kafusi had a good preseason. It wasn't nearly as good as Urban, so Urban was the team's best player other than Jalen Hill in the preseason. And I do expect some drop-off, but hopefully we'll get a nice positive surprise out of Kafusi.
All right. Well, you should be excited about this. The NFL analyst is asking you, is Brandon Williams really that important to the D-line? The limited data would suggest yes, but I'll listen to your answer off the air.
And that's the only way we give answers here, is off the air, us being internet radio and whatnot. So Brandon Williams, yes, he is that important to the defensive line. I hope that people who were opposed to the Brandon Williams signing understand just how critical he is to the function of the defense as a whole. The pressure he gets, the double teams he commands on the inside are absolutely critical. And there's a critical mass you get, not to use a pun, between Brandon Williams and Pierce, that you have two guys who often require a double team. And that's very hard for the offense to account for. Sometimes they have to bring a backup and try and chip, but they have to do a lot of things special to try and get that guy blocked. And that's freed up a lot of the outside linebackers and Brent Urban as well to win those other one-on-one matchups. So Brandon Williams makes the other players around him much better. So that's my answer.
All right. Next question comes from Whiter Than Beach.
I think that might be Whiter Than Beach.
Whiter Than Beach. Where could the defense benefit most from a free agent signing?
Okay, well, a week ago I'd have told you inside linebacker was the place to get a free agent signing, and Gerald Hodges is still out there and available. He's a nice two-down run stopper that the Ravens could really make use of, I think, with the defense they have. With Correa taking a step forward, I got a new answer this week.
Injuries should affect as well.
And injuries should affect that as well. But injuries are part of my reason why I don't really want the Ravens to make another free agent acquisition of any significant dollar value this season. I just think it's wasted money at this point. And the Ravens may make the playoffs. I do not believe they're outfitted to be a Super Bowl contender. I hope I'm wrong. I hope they make a deep playoff run. But we got to think about 2018 and 2019. And those are the years you're borrowing cap from to sign somebody this year. So I'm not a fan of it at this point. I'd rather just stand pat with the defensive players we have.
All right. I like this next question, because a lot was made in the past couple weeks about the fact that Eric Weddle is wearing gloves this year because he felt like he dropped too many interception opportunities last year. So Chris Sadowski asks, does Eric Weddle's early missed tackles concern you going forward?
Eric Weddle was out of position a lot in this game. On the touchdown that was over Mosley to Mercedes Lewis, he was out of position. His overall level of play was kind of weak. He missed a tackle in the backfield for a sack. That was very costly. Ended up being a gain of seven, and I can't even remember if that would have stalled a drive or not. But, it was one of the breakdowns in the Ravens' pass rush that was frustrating. So, I'm in general bothered by his level of play. The missed tackles specifically are not the reason, but I am generally bothered by his level of play.
All right. Milan Che, we're just going to go with that, on Twitter says, did you see Pease make any adjustments after halftime? It looked like the same vanilla when I'm watching on TV.
You know, that's a good question to look at. And I'm looking at my score sheet here, and I'm seeing they got more pressure in the second half, but they effectively used almost all four-man pressure again. They did use six a couple of times in, twice in the second half. But no, they weren't passing as much in the entire second half, so the Jaguars only threw nine passes or only had nine dropbacks in the second half. So there wasn't a big opportunity. The opportunity was in the first half when they threw the ball 24 times to get some pressure then. It didn't happen. The Ravens were down 23-0, and the game was effectively over.
And I heard Jared Johnson on the radio yesterday, I believe, talking about this, and he said that in his experience, teams normally don't shift and make much changes during halftime. That Rex Ryan would tear everything up and try to teach a new defense during halftime and go completely all out. But besides him, there would never be that big of adjustments.
Right. I believe that. There's only so much you can do. And if you want to talk to one veteran player about how you want him to play different, I think that's possible. I look back at the way some different usage of Flacco, like in the Ravens win over the Patriots at Foxborough. They were down, I think, 13-7 at that. Yeah, it was 13-7, and they won the second half 21-0 to go to the Super Bowl. In that game, they decided they were going to open up. They put Flacco on the shotgun, went to no huddle. You can make a change like that if the no huddle is something you know how to run. But in terms of running a whole new defensive scheme, of course they can't do that.
Yeah, I think the offense is going to be easier to shift because you can say, hey, this worked, let's do it more. Mm-hmm. Where the defense, it's all in response to what their team is doing.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Air Nugget asks, as we continue with these weird Twitter names, Air Nugget says, what percentage of that dumpster fire performance the Ravens put up would you attribute to Williams' absence? Where in the world did the pass rush disappear to?
I think we covered kind of both these questions at one time with the defensive line, so let's kind of review. But I would assess a pretty significant percentage of the problem was Williams' absence. Not the offensive problems, but of the defense's failure to get the Jaguars stopped. Maybe 20% could be assigned to Williams' absence, and another big part of it could be assigned to the fact that Urban was then lost, and that combination was very, very bad. Webb didn't have a good game, and Weddle didn't have a good game, and Jefferson was kind of subpar in this game. So you had a few players that didn't get it done, but as far as who are the biggest two players, the absence of the players on the defensive line was a big problem, and then the more significant problem even than that was the outside linebackers failing to get pressure, which was related to those defensive line absences.
All right. Mr. Air Nugget would also like you to talk a little bit about the offense and Alex Collins. He seems to be trending upwards. Do you expect to see his usage increase this upcoming week against the Steelers?
Okay, well, one way to handicap any kind of running back usage is the more somebody fumbles, the less they're going to play. So when McGahee had fumbling problems, he rode the pine for a while. In past years, we've had that happen with other running backs as well. But West's fumble and probably the way he reacted to it when he was talking to Harbaugh on the sideline, I do not believe are going to sit well. I think West is going to get a significant reduction in carries. I think they'll use some of Allen still, who hasn't coughed it up yet that I can recall, and they'll use some of Collins as well, and we'll see. Those be the primary two of the three backs. I think we'll see West less than one third of the carries this next week.
All right, two more questions for you. At Jimmy Orr 21, who is this defense, the Week 1 and 2 defense, or the one we saw in London? What's the real Ravens defense?
Wow, if we knew that, we'd really have the $64,000 question solved. But we've got to hope, and sometimes hope's the only strategy you have, that the Ravens' failures this last week were all due to the exigencies of playing in London, the difficulties of that, and not the not something fundamentally wrong with this team structurally that they can't solve with the defensive linemen they have. So I'm hoping they figure it out schematically in time to play one of the most important games of the season, and can get their defense back to providing pressure that will create some turnovers from Ben.
All right, so Ken is blaming Peter Angelos, travel, and the protests.
I'm with you.
Final question from you is from at Dean Pease. How do I stop the Steelers?
At Dean Pease, I appreciate you asking the question. First-time caller, long-time listener, first-time caller, right? But in terms of how you do this, you've got to rely on the cornerbacks to get it done, largely in man coverage. Relying on cover two entirely in this game is probably a mistake, because I think you're going to need the safeties in the box to make plays and force turnovers. Whether that means Jefferson's coming on the blitz, or Weddle is doing some of the same, or you're trying to undercut Bell in the box, all of those things are going to be things you're going to need to rely on a one safety, one deep safety situation.
All right, I really hope they can do that, and I really hope, as you were answering the previous question, that this isn't what we're going to see going forward like we saw in London. All right, Ken, welcome back to America, and where can people continue to read your write-ins and interact?
Okay, appreciate that. And you can look online on Russell Street Report. Look for Film Study, Ravens, and Ken. You can find it on Google. But I'm there. There's more detail there and allows you to kind of follow through the game observation by observation. On Twitter, I'm at Film Study Ravens. And Josh, let's do the same for you. You are?
I am at Josh Soroka on Twitter. JOSHSROKA. Not hard, easy to pronounce, but very hard to spell, apparently, according to my junk mail. This week on Section 336, we talked about this game because it was an emotional loss, but we also talked about the Orioles and the fact that this is the first losing season since 2011, and what does that mean? As well as Sunday was J.J. Hardy's last game as an Oriole at Camden Yards, and kind of we appreciated J.J. Hardy a little bit as well.
Okay, and he homered on Sunday, right?
Yeah, because that's what baseball has, a way of magic showing up on certain occasions. You think of Cal Ripken, and he had it many times with home runs in his last All-Star game, a home run in 21-31.
So 30.
Yeah, if you're a betting guy, you kind of want to bet on J.J. Hardy, who only has 4 home runs for the year, would get one in his final home game. It just, baseball works out that way. Unfortunately, the season doesn't mean anything and they lost, but you can still pick out these little moments that mean something in baseball, and J.J. Hardy's home run did it this week.
I just want to connect these two things because I think they're both important, and I have tremendous historical affinity with my team, and you clearly do with the Orioles at a minimum, Josh. You know, you've been a fan for a long time, but the things that matter historically to me were not getting shut out in this game was very important. A shutout is a black mark on the franchise for good. I feel the same way about your team getting no hit. I don't want to see a no hitter ever that's against my team, even though it's seeing a no hitter. I feel the same way about the consecutive winning seasons. It was something huge to give up in my youth when they broke their string of 18 straight winning seasons in 1986, and it was an unbelievable collapse that had happened during. This has been a similar horrible September of falling apart, when it looked like they were, what, 3 or even 4 games over 500 at one point. It looked like they probably were going to make it.
Yeah, they were in it at one point in September, or I guess... Yeah, beginning of September, they're one game out of the wild card. So they were in it, and then they collapsed fast.
They did, and now they're going to lose the best record in the American League since 2012.
Yes, or
since
2011. The Yankees have that now.
Okay. Yes. And the Indians got to be close, too, so that's an interesting...
Yeah, they might be catching up. But, hey, there's always next year that the Orioles can somehow maybe bring it back.
Yeah.
All right, Josh. All right, Ken. Well, we will talk soon for our next episode, where you are going to tell me that there was an offensive line in London, because I didn't see one on Yahoo.
All right.
So I'll talk to you then.